Well, I guess these computers have taken over the world. I didn't know that when you shut one off, it stayed on. And they've changed the operating system on this desktop thing, and I can't find my own music. I can hardly find my right hand and left hand, but I did want to play for you that piece from Lewis Black on the proliferation of Starbucks as a prelude to these, to this little lecture today on the economy. You can actually stand on the Texas Tech campus in a particular spot and essentially be in between two Starbucks that are more or less across the street, one from another. One is at the Student Union, the other is on University Avenue. And everywhere you go, commerce has taken over, at least that particular one. So I thought that was kind of interesting anyway. All right, second of three presentations in this fifth segment dealing with interest-based social institutions. We took care of health and medicine on Tuesday, the economy today, and on Tuesday we'll have politics and government being the last of the three presentations. And on Wednesday we'll have a review for exam five, which will be Thursday. So 4 o'clock Wednesday is the review. Test is a week from today, and that will take care of the first five tests. Now, a couple of people have asked me, how do I figure out whether or not I should take the final? Well, it comes down to fifth grade arithmetic, basically, but you got to think about it a little bit. If after, let's say, Thursday's exam, your total in the class is, let's say, 239, so you're 4 points short of an A, you're going to get four more attendance points, so you just need to show up for the last section of the class, and then you'll get the A, because that'll put it to 243, and that'll be fine. But let's say your test and attendance point score after Thursday is 235, okay? And the last Greg Abbott point day is going to be in the final segment of the course. And so you can get 4 points that way. So that takes you to 239. You're still 4 points short. How are you going to get an A on the in the course by taking the final? You have to, on the final, you have to get four more points than your previous lowest test grade. Are you with me so far? Because one test will be dropped. You know, sometimes people ask me, I only need 60 points. Does that mean if I get 30 on the last two tests? Well, no, because you're dropping one. So if you have 239 total with the last Greg Abbott, and your lowest test score, let's say, is a 40, what do you need on the final to get an A? You need 4 points better than 40 to go from 239 to 243. Does that make sense? So you need a 44. Who's even minimally confused by this? Just in general, then, and I'll let it go, because I'll say this again and you get an email to this effect. Once you determine what your point total is, you have to beat that, and you're short of the grade you want. You have to beat your lowest test score on the final by the same number of points you need to bump your grade up. Fair enough? Okay, because we are going to drop one test. Okay, any other questions about any other thing to this point? Okay. All right, let me just go through this material then on probably the most interest-based of the interest-based social institutions, the economic lecture dealing with the institution of the economy. An economic system, let's just define that. An economic system is the social institution through which, goods and services, things you buy, things you pay people to do for you, the social institution through which goods and services are produced. And I forgot the next word in the definition. Hold on. It's going to sound good on the tape. Are produced, distributed, and consumed. So we've got a production process in the economy. Goods and services are produced, then somehow they're disseminated or distributed throughout the country or the world, and then we consume them. We buy them, we use them, we purchase disposable commodities, whatever it is, grass seed, spare ribs, iPhones, what have you. A monopoly is the control of a market by a single business firm. The control of a market by a single business firm. And these are generally illegal, because if you're the only one that sells dip widgets, and dip widgets is something everybody needs, and then you can set the price whatever you want. There's no competition. So monopolies are generally illegal. There are exceptions. Public utilities, for example, the electric company, or the gas company, or the water company, tend to be monopolized, you know, but they are also politicized. And so to the extent to which utility rates are regulated has to do with the political process that elects the regulators. Amtrak is a monopoly. It is a privately held company, and it delivers passenger rail service to the U.S. It is the only one, because passenger rail service is very, very hard to make cost effective in a country this size. Amtrak loses money every year. And yet Amtrak is subsidized by the federal government because we collectively agree that passenger rail service is a necessary component of our culture. And the economy is boosted for people who do that by government subsidies. And that's also politicized. So there are very few legitimate monopolies. And something like Facebook is coming under review by the Federal Trade Commission as being a company without a competitor. And if that's true, different sets of regulations will be put in place. This whole Facebook flap is rather remarkable and unique. The thing that Facebook has done to run afoul of culture, God, and country, I guess, is to put out something that all of us use without telling us fully how they were using us. I mean, I think it was Tim Cook, who's the CEO of Apple, said, "We sell iPhones, Facebook sells people." You know, that we're in effect the people, we ourselves are commodities. I thought that was a pretty astute observation and not terribly far from the truth. And we haven't even invented the regulatory process to regulate something that is so unique. And one of the things that is helping people try to figure this out are the monopoly laws, the laws against a single entity controlling a market. And when that occurs, there are regulatory processes that are put into place to deal with it. Anyway, monopoly, the control of a market by a single business firm. Social surplus involves producing more goods and services than you personally need to survive. Now, this goes back to the transition, which I'll talk about in a minute, from hunting and gathering to horticultural to agrarian societies. The simplest societies simply grow food, or find food, I should say, to meet their own needs. Then they learn how to grow it. And then we become really good farmers, such that we grow more wheat, corn, soybeans, produce more cattle than our family needs, which means we can sell it. The stuff, the commodities businesses have to sell are in fact a social surplus. And I'll explain that in more detail in just about 3 minutes. The definition of social surplus, though, is a production of more goods and more product than the individual needs of that product. And finally, laissez-faire is a French term that translates "let them do." It's a form of capitalism. It's a form of capitalism that is largely unregulated, assuming that market forces will regulate itself. Now, this is pretty unusual. This is sort of the libertarian view of how the economy should run. Let them do. Let them figure it out. And if you're selling a product for too much money, nobody will buy it. If you sell a product for less money than what it costs you to produce, you'll go bankrupt. And there's a sweet spot in there. And let them do means you figure out the sweet spot. These are just introductory concepts that sort of set the stage for the rest of this presentation. Let me talk about the evolution of economies, the evolution of economies from pre-industrial to industrial to post-industrial societies. Okay? The simplest form of social organization, the simplest economic form, is a hunting and gathering society. And if you've ever seen the movie The Gods Must Be Crazy, which came out probably 25 plus years ago, it's the depiction of a hunter-gatherer society in which there are only two kinds of people, hunters and gatherers, duh. The women do the gathering, the men do the hunting. Almost no stratification at all in a hunting and gathering society because the two jobs are equally necessary. This involves a group of nomads living in a very remote part of sub-Saharan Africa, about 600 miles from Johannesburg, the capital of South Africa. And somehow in the movie, which is kind of a reality-type docudrama, really, a small plane flies over the village. Well, they've never seen the plane before. They've never known what an airplane is. And the pilot, for the sake of the drama in the movie, drops a Coca-Cola bottle out of the plane, and it lands in the middle of this village, and they've never seen anything like it. Imagine a Coca-Cola bottle in your head. Fair enough? Well, these hunter-gatherers are very good at making use out of just about anything they can find. They believe that the spirit world will take care of them and that the gods have given them this wonderful thing, which they start doing wonderful things with. You know, they make music, that kind of thing. They use it to grind grain. They use it to tan leather. And and there's only one of them, right? So what's happened to this little hunter-gatherer society is that literally capitalism has landed in the middle of their village. And for about a week, this is wonderful. Until two people want the wonderful thing at the same time, right? Because there's only one of them. It's a scarce resource. And then there's competition for scarce resources, which is the technical definition of war. And pretty soon, somebody who was using it to grind grain and then gave it up to somebody that wanted to make music took it away from them and started to use it as a weapon and bonked them over the head. And this had never been seen in this little hunter-gatherer society. And so the rest of the movie involves somebody, one of the villagers, trying to take it and throw it off the end of the earth because the earth is flat. You should see it because it's a remarkable depiction of the simplicity of hunter-gatherers in an era and an age and a remote spot far away from Facebook and Russian bots, as it were. And, you know, you're tempted to sort of think that's idyllic, but it's not. It's just different. And it's sort of a parable or a morality play on the pluses and minuses of capitalism, literally in this instance, dropping into your village, which becomes a kind of metaphor for us landing in an advanced capitalist society, if you will. So that's what hunter-gatherers do. It's a simple world, and yet they have to move around because you can gather up and hunt out pretty much everything where you are. And the evolution from hunter-gatherer to horticultural comes about when some of the hunter-gatherers figure out that some of the things they have gathered have seeds in them. And if you plant the seeds, you can grow food and not have to move around to hunt for it. And then you get good at it. And here's where the social surplus kicks in. We get so good at growing tomatoes or ultimately corn and soybeans that we produce more of what we're growing or raising, if you will, cattle for milk and meat and all that, that we can then sell it. Well, then not everybody in the culture has to be a farmer. In fact, it requires some in the culture to learn how to be a veterinarian or a blacksmith and so on. And that becomes an agrarian society that is tipped forward into industry. So hunter-gatherers are the simplest form. They hunt food and gather up things, other things to eat and sustain themselves. And, you know, things that they turn into, you know, textiles, cotton, animal hides, and so on. They start planting and they don't have to travel. And then they get good at planting and they can sell the stuff. And pretty soon we need plows and machines and fuel, and we become an industrial society. Industrial societies have three types of industries. Primary industries extract raw materials from the ground or from the environment. So can you give me an example of a primary industry that's well known on the South Plains of West Texas?
Cotton.
Cotton, of course, growing cotton. What else? Oil production, natural gas, and so on. These are the primary industries that extract raw materials. Secondary industries turn these raw materials into finished products. So for those who extract oil from the ground as a primary industry, to whom do they sell it? Which secondary industry do they sell their oil? Sure, to the refiners, right? That turn oil from the ground into gasoline and all the other things that are oil-based consumer products. So we turn raw materials into finished products. We call those secondary industries. Tertiary industries are industries that provide services, wholesaling and retailing. You know, you can make a living simply selling space in your warehouse to people who bring finished products to store there to be brought to market, if you will. So retailing and warehousing. Education is a tertiary industry. We are providing the service of information and insight and truth and humor and insight and all the great things that you didn't know exist, and this existed until you signed up for this class. Ha 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 ha. Primary industries extract raw materials. Secondary industries convert raw materials to finished products. Tertiary industries provide services. And you see how the economy starts to hum and buzz. Well, we have arguably become more advanced technologically and socially beyond industrialization. Now, let me just pause for a second and link pre-industrial to industrial societies. Farmers used to simply walk through the fields, digging furrows with sticks and plant seeds, right? Well, some of them figured out you could construct a particular kind of stick, name it a plow, attach it to a horse, and much more quickly cut furrows. And then people figured out if you put a grain sack on a trailer and cut a hole in the grain sack, you can actually plant this way. Well, it's before too long, we have invented plows, engines, combines, and have found the fuel to run them. So machines come into play. Well, we have gone beyond the point, and machines were the world's most valuable commodity for a very long time. The Industrial Revolution happens in Europe beginning in the around 1800 or so. We're starting to build machines and so on. And that lasts until, I think, arguably, machines are the most valuable commodity in society, in an industrial society, at least until the 50s and 60s in the US. And in 1968, I think, a scholar, observer of society, social analyst named Daniel Bell wrote a book called The Post-Industrial Society. The Post-Industrial Society. And what he posed in that book is that machines are losing their value in favor of information. That information was becoming the most valuable resource. We had in the 50s large computers that were helping businesses run their accounting department, and then we learned to attach computerized controls to machines, and et cetera, et cetera. And then we learned to store and retrieve information. And information storage and retrieval systems have gotten pretty darn sophisticated. Honestly, it just blows my mind in a way to think that I sent my first email ever while I was in graduate school in 1992, I think. And it was a very complicated thing. There was no such thing as hypertext transfer protocols, in other words, web pages. The screen just looked like a black screen that had green characters on it. And you had to send in, first of all, you had to call up the connection to the server, and you had to write these words, something like mail to, M-A-I-L-T-O, comma, quotation mark, email address, period, quotation mark, comma, all this kind of syntax. And until you got really good at that, most of what happened when you tried to send your email was you got a message that said invalid character or something like that. And after about four of those, you got out a hammer and wanted to use it, which we still do, I think, in different ways for different reasons. I mean, it's stunning to me how just, and this is just an example, how just the process of sending an email has gotten so much less complicated than even 25 years ago. And what we have paid for that is the sort of black boxes that have been constructed between you and the email server and the however it manages to show up. I mean, you could send an email from your phone right now to the person sitting next to you and it would be there right like that. And you don't have any idea where that thing has been and what process by which those little characters have gone, and you don't care. You know, text messaging has even probably taken over email in terms of how we communicate. And it's almost like the genie's out of the bottle now. And this, I mean, just the latest news on what the information Facebook has been able to compile and what they chose to do with it, even unwittingly, gives us a clue of how complicated and how valuable information is. I guess the best way to say it is that now that Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos and others in the techno world are the wealthiest people, the nerds have won. You know, the big strong machines, as it were, and the machinists that ran them, are becoming almost a thing of the past. We still need machines and machinists, but not as many of them and not as urgently as much as we need information retrieval and storage. And the question is how you manage the tension between detecting things and storing them and protecting what you stored. Get the idea? Silly, stupid example going back many years. I was one of the first, because Texas did this, I think, for the first time in 96 or 97, to get a driver's license with a magnetic strip on the back. Now, these are pretty well becoming obsolete, too. Pretty soon, we're going to have a chip like we do on our credit cards, you know, which will be more digital. Magnets can wear out. Chips are more durable. But anyway, these are designed such that if you are stopped by a law enforcement entity and they want to know more things than are on the front, they can slide this thing through and, you know, do you have any warrants or any other such thing? It'll pop up on a screen. There's a lot of information encoded on this little magnetic strip or on your credit card through your chip. Well, I don't know where that information comes from, except my guess is it's the quiz you have to take every once in a while when you have to get your driver's license renewed to ask you a bunch of questions. And on that quiz, typically, is a question like this. Have you ever been treated for high blood pressure? A whole list of things, and high blood pressure's on it. And I'm going, wait a second, I'm not sure that's any of your beeswax. I take two blood pressure drugs, as it turns out. Don't tell the driver's license people, because they don't know. Because I adopted Nancy Reagan's advice, and when you talk about drugs, just say no. So I just said no. And the reason I did that, which for all I know is a felony, lying on your driver's license application, I don't know if that's like lying to the FBI or not. Is Robert Mueller going to get me? I don't know.
Sounds on tape, bro.
Yeah, I know. I'm going to put this on the internet, so you don't have to keep it a secret. Here's the thing. I tried to figure this out. I asked, what happens if I say no to these questions? Because the other one on there, have you ever been treated for addictive disease? That's even more private if you ask me, you know. And they did ask me. And, it's clear that the only answer that matters on these kinds of quizzes when you do this for stuff like that is no. And if it's yes, then what? Well, I had a little extra time and I kind of felt sorry for the person that drew me next in line because I said, what happens if I say yes to this? And this is the frontline person at the DMV and their whole job is to move people through as fast as possible. Or as inconveniently as possible. And bless her heart, she just said, sir, I don't know. And I said, okay, that's fine. So I just said, no, if you don't know, I don't care. Right? And that's just the tiniest, simplest, stupidest example I can think of raising the question in your own mind, what happens to this information? Well, we have stopped essentially asking that question. We have basically stopped asking that question every time we hit a website, send an email, post something on Facebook, send out a tweet. What happens to it? could be anything, right? Including nothing at all. You know, I missed a meeting yesterday because somehow I didn't get an email that nailed down the date. The last email I got relevant to the meeting that occurred yesterday without me was, who can come to a meeting on this day at this time? And there was about a 50-50 split on all the responses. And then I just was waiting around for, okay, give me the confirming date, I'll be there. Didn't happen. So I got a text message from one of my colleagues. You on your way? I go, to what? The meeting. Didn't get the memo. Went to your email. Oh, really? Went to your email is not necessarily, you know, from your finger to God's mind to where it's supposed to go. Anybody ever gotten crossed with an email? I didn't get the email. That's a legit answer, frighteningly, in our world. I had a couple different conversations just in the last few days about even the evolution of higher technology. Just 5 years ago, I got into a sort of philosophical discussion with somebody over something that happened to me when I was on the phone trying to deal with car insurance. And I needed something done, and the person on the other end of the phone said, quote, the computer won't let me do that. That's when I pitched a fit. I said, put me on the phone with somebody who runs the computer. You know, the computer won't let me do that. At 5 years ago, that didn't seem to me to be a legitimate answer, because the computer is a tool. I want to talk to the tool user, not the result of the tool. Well, friends and neighbors, in the last 5 years, we have almost been forced to legitimate that answer, because the computerization of our world has become so complicated that half the time I just give up. It took me about 5 minutes of voicemail hell to get through to Suddenlink Communications the other day. I have my phone landline and my internet connection through Suddenlink at home, and I decided I didn't need the landline, so I was going to cut that off. It took literally 5 minutes of, please say why you're doing this, and I couldn't. Anyway, finally get a real person. And I tell her what I want, and she said, "And have you noticed all these frontline people are women? You know, so that suggests to me it doesn't pay very much. But that's another story." And I try to be nice and decent and gentle, because I know these are crap jobs in a lot of ways, dealing with people that can get edgy over this stuff like I know I can, right? Why, sir, would you want to cancel your landline? Because I never use it. And most of the time when it rings, it's some scammer spoofing Apple telling me my iCloud has been compromised, and I know they're lying. That happened every 15 minutes for about 4 hours a week ago. Well, sir, let me look at your account. I see you have bundled service with us. Yes, I do. Well, if we cut your landline, the cost of your internet will go up higher than the cost of your bundle, which, by the way, I can cut for $10 if you keep the landline today. What? Okay, fine. And, by the way, I notice that you have outdated service. We can speed up your internet service. Good idea. Wouldn't mind that. So I called them to cut off the landline. At the end of the conversation, I still had the landline for $10 less and doubled the speed of the internet service. And I'm going, Toto, we are not in Kansas anymore. You know? This is post-industrial societies. We relied on machines. Now we are relying on servers. And more frighteningly, the people who run them and the people who invade them. Right? To what effect? That's what a post-industrial society is. It's a transition from machines to information becoming the most valuable commodity. That's just what it is. From a conflict point of view, that transition is met with two words: so what? The more things change, the more they stay the same. It doesn't matter from a conflict perspective what all this functionality, and let me just throw that in because it's not on the outline, and it isn't vital. But by now, maybe you understood that the whole point of the advancement of technology is to create functional processes by which we get internet and phone and God knows what all else. From a conflict point of view, the transition from industrial to post-industrial culture or post-industrial economy makes no difference. It has no discernible impact on the difference in gaps between haves and have-nots. It just changes who the most have people are. The wealthiest people are no longer the owners of car companies. The wealthiest people are the owners of technology companies. End of story. It doesn't make the gap between haves and have-nots change. In fact, it may make it worse. Anytime you have more and more things that more and more people want that you can actually regulate the quantity of, you know, I had pondered getting a new iPhone. And then I thought, I wonder how long I have to wait for this thing. And maybe it's on my list of things to investigate, and I just haven't gotten around to it. But one of the things that goes through your mind is, you know, how big a hassle is this going to be to get the gizmo and then get the gizmo to work like I want it? And the answer in my own head is usually pretty big hassle. You know, they tricked me into updating the operating system on this thing. And for one thing, it's a Windows platform, which I don't know anything about anymore. And I can't find the folder that's got my music in it. I just can't do it. So now I got to call the technology people, who we didn't used to frickin' need, right? I should get back to my notes, because I'm starting to sound like your grandpa. And I'm plenty old enough to be all your grandpas. And I'm starting to feel like it, actually. Well, by gosh, you know, my wife's dad died about 7 or 8 years ago, and that was when all the computer virus thing was coming really to the fore. And every time there'd be a new thing about something, some new virus was invading our PCs and so on, he would just go, that's one less thing I need to worry about. Because you didn't have a computer, you know. I'm starting to feel like my dear old late father-in-law, Raleigh. I can hear Raleigh's voice in my head every time I have to do this stuff and go, huh, Raleigh never worried about that. What the hell? As we speak, folks, the computer won't let me do that. Seriously? I just lost the input. Okay, this is on tape. Yeah. I just dissed the people we have to call to fix this stuff. You know, I don't know but what there isn't a microphone in this room that somebody on the other end of that phone line when I call says, ha, we'll fix him. I literally don't know what to do. I have hit the only button I know to hit. In 9 minutes, the power will turn off and go into standby mode automatically. I'm sorry, Dave, I can't do that. Does anybody even know the allusion to that line? Yeah, it's out of 2001. I don't know how to stop this. They've invaded the microphone. All right, I'm just going to let this go because you all have the outline, right? I'm going to have to get the outline in a different place because it's a good thing this was going to be a short lecture. Apparently not. Got the outline. This has not happened before. I don't know how I can stop this. I have 8 minutes until the end of the earth. I don't know. All right, we're going to pretend that we still live in the 20th century for a minute. We could actually use chalk if we had a chalkboard. I don't believe that. Not if I start, if I leave that up there, I can't even get rid of it. Honest to God, I am befuddled by this. And we're talking about the befuddledness of technology. Well, somebody's going to get a phone call, and it's going to take me 5 minutes to go through voicemail to get to the person, too. You know what I should do is call the number and put it on speaker? That won't help anything. All right. Let me talk about postmodernism, which we're apparently going to get into in 7 minutes. Postmodernism is a difficult term to define because as soon as you define it, you go afoul of it. The best way I know to define postmodernism is the diffusion of boundaries. Boundaries have become more fluid and flexible. The internet, I think, is a good example of how boundaries to what you can learn or see. You can take a virtual tour of the Vatican if you want to. And you can learn probably 80 or 90% of what you can learn by going there, you know? So boundaries have become more diffuse. Cultural boundaries, I think, are more interesting. What is music? I think the first example that I'm aware of that I think illustrates this pretty well is the music of Yoko Ono. You know who I'm talking about? John Lennon, the late John Lennon's wife, Japanese artist. And if you've never heard any of her music, you might want to go to iTunes and don't buy anything if you don't want to. Just listen to the sample piece that they'll give you. There's a lot of screeching and a lot of scratching and a lot of things that you go, that doesn't sound like music to me. And yet, the boundary between what is and isn't music is diffuse. That's postmodernism. You might want to consider, the next time you're near an art museum, go see if you can find a painting by Jackson Pollock. You know, been around for quite a while. He's been gone for several decades. Jackson Pollock came up with the idea of putting emotions on canvas in a very visceral way. He would put a canvas on the floor and dip a brush into a paint can of varying colors and just emotionally splatter the canvas. And a lot of people that look at a Jackson Pollock painting will say, you know what, I can do that. And I'm going, well, I bet you wish you'd thought of it, because that thing on the wall is worth about $1.2 million. You know? Jackson Pollock died drunk and penniless. His estate is doing very well, you know? Because somebody decided not only was that art, it's a rare form of art. And I have to tell you, there's a Jackson Pollock painting in the Dallas Art Museum that is in a sort of obscure corner. And I walked around the corner and saw it and went, ah, Pollock. And I just went up and stood next to it like this. And I took off my glasses because I have a focal range in my real eyes of about this far. And I just looked at it for a while and kind of experienced it. I know that's weird. I like that kind of modern art, not because of the visual nature of it, because I couldn't even see it. I like how I feel when I'm around it. It evokes emotion. It evokes feeling. Picasso does the same thing. Now, that's an acquired taste for a lot of people. My mother would go to an art museum and see on a wall a 10 by 10 foot canvas that was painted entirely black except for one little white dot, you know, or something goofy like that. And her answer would be, I could do that. Well, then do it. It's okay with me. I kind of like how I felt when I experienced it. And that's what made it art for me. Well, that whole negotiation of what is and isn't art, what is and isn't music, is a reflection of what we have called, and of course we have bounded, we've put boundaries around what we're talking about by giving it a label, postmodernism. A pure philosophical postmodernist would say we cannot even discuss this, because as soon as we discuss it, we have made the boundaries more rigid by giving it labels and names, right? And you might want to go to lunch with people that live in that world philosophically, but probably not more than once. I don't know, as it were. That's what postmodernism is. At this point, let me just ask if there are any questions about any of these are mostly terms and definitions and concepts. Anything you'd like me to redefine or say more about? Yes, sir. Yeah, sort of implied in that was the idea that technology is designed to produce functionality. Fair enough? And the transition from an industrial to an information age, from a conflict point of view, changes nothing culturally. It just changes the name of the most valuable resource. It doesn't change the ratio of who gets what at all. It just changes who gets more and may change who gets less, but it doesn't change the proportion at all. That make sense? Okay. What else? Why am I looking up at that thing? Have you noticed this? My whole way of doing this is to be out here, you know, performing and imparting truth and depending on the technology to remind me what I'm next supposed to talk about. Now I have to go here. No, I don't. Watch this. Watch this. I'm back in business. You had no idea how bad this was going to suck when you walked into this room today. Aspects of the U.S. economy today, two things. One of the things that has not changed from a conflict point of view in the U.S. economy today is the access to and role of and empowerment of women. It is still harder for women to break through the glass ceiling in a post-industrial world. The chief operating officer of Facebook is a woman whose name escapes me. Everybody knows Mark Zuckerberg's name. Do you know who the COO is? The woman with the long black hair that's been on the news lately? Nobody can name her? Interesting, because she was all over the news, almost to the extent that Zuckerberg was. My point. The other aspect of the economy today that is different is the underground economy. We've talked a little bit about both of these things, but in a post-industrial information age, we still need pre-industrial laborers to pick vegetables and fruit. Immigrant labor is now a part of what I would call the underground economy because, Trump world notwithstanding, an enormous amount of fruit and vegetables is being picked and processed today by illegal immigrants. Houses are being built and roads are being constructed and animals are being slaughtered by undocumented workers who are at the lowest end of what I call the underground economy. The other piece of the underground economy is the illegal drug business, which has had an incursion by the legalization of cannabis products in a substantial proportion of the country, and that's going to probably proliferate. You know, there will come a day when cannabis is legal in Texas in the same way that it's legal in California and Oregon and other places. Well, that market has competed with and in many ways successfully overcome the illegal marijuana growers, and now the illegal drug industry is being supplied by heroin and or poppy growers, poppy farmers instead of cannabis farmers. So illegal drugs, the role of women, and illegal labor are, I think, crucial aspects of what characterize the economy today in as significant, if not as obvious a way, as the information age, as the transition from industrialization to information. The underground economy, I would say, is as prominent and important as anything else. From a functionalist point of view, a discussion of a capitalist economy is pretty simple. In partnership with families who teach kids values and work ethics, in partnership with primary public, private, and secondary education, the talent pool and workforce is trained and made available to work in the economy. So family, economy, and education work together to produce functionality. Family and education energize the economy with values and skills. Fair enough? Well, that comes apart, arguably, from a conflict point of view. It does two things. It further stratifies our world through division of labor, and it creates almost a kind of micro concept that Marx came up with and is ever increasingly more true, arguably, called alienation. Remember when I did the widget and dipwackle piece? And my job was to put a widget on a dipwackle and make a dip widget and move it up the line? Well, there are very few products these days that are that simple, that have only two moving parts, A plus B equals product. Even assembly lines in factories. People who work in production of goods are individually doing less to contribute to the finished product than they used to. You know, my job is to put the screw in the widget that becomes a part of, etc. You know, that's my only job. Marx argued, and I think it's becoming more prominently the case, that the further you are from the finished product, the more alienated you are in your work. So that's taking this Marxist notion of the dehumanization of culture and the stratification of haves and have-nots, the tension between the bourgeoisie and the proletariat, and making it very personal. So the concept of alienation is kind of a bridge between Marxist conflict theory and labeling theory, which is a part of the micro world. I did it again. I just looked up at the blank screen. On a micro level, using in part this notion of alienation, we make a distinction between an occupation and a profession, a job as opposed to a career. Who works a job right now? One that, you know, if you quit tomorrow or if today you got fired, pretty soon somebody, maybe by the day after tomorrow, could come in and do the job you're doing. Fair enough? Okay. And, you know, the check's clear, etc. And I'm not going to do this the rest of my life. That's fine. Our identity is less wrapped up in an occupation. You might say, you might not say, if, you know, what do? You might say, well, I take orders at McDonald's. Or you might say, I'm a sophomore at Texas Tech. You know, which identity do you want, even though they're both true? Professions typically involve higher prestige, longer training, and, you know, a little more pride in the label. You get business cards when you become a professional. And then I wonder to myself, what do you do when you're not that anymore? There's a card in a slot on my office door that has my name and my title, Professor of Sociology, and Associate Chair, SASW. I'm the Associate Chair of the department. It's kind of like being the Vice President. It's the greatest job. It's the greatest administrative job in the world. Because you, if anybody wants you to do something that you really don't want to do or that's of some consequence, you say, you got to take that to the chair. I can't handle that. Above my pay grade. It's not quite true. But I know that that job is going to end in 2 months, 6 days, 4 hours, and 12 minutes. Keep track. Because the chair job is going to be vacant. Our chair is moving to a different job. He's ending his job, and when his job ends, my job ends. Because the new chair will come from the sociology division, and the associate chair has to come from a different division. You didn't need to know all this. My question is, what am I going to do with that card on my door? Then I have to ask myself, who put it there in the first place? I don't know. So I don't know who to ask to take that off. You know what I'm going to do? I decided this because I noticed it this morning, and I know that this is going to happen. I could go to the office and say to the person that's our administrative assistant, Can you find out who does these things and make me a new one? And she might or might not be able to do that. I'm going to fix it with a Sharpie. That's how old school I am. But the point is, there's a matter of identity that goes with this. You know, who, in addition to me, has ever been fired from a job? You walk in, you think you still have a job, and then you learn by the end of the day, you do not. Anybody? Twice? Wait, just live a little longer. That's a pretty serious hit to who you think you are, right? Because we do, our jobs, where we work, it's a pretty important part of what Goffman called the self that we present, right? Presentation of self in everyday life. I love it that I have a choice, at least for now, because I'm retiring from the clergy gig. You've probably noticed I like to screw with people's heads if I can, just for fun. Try not to be mean about it. But when I go to out of town by myself, typically conferences, every once in a while, if I've got some time, I'll take some golf clubs with me, because I do that every now and then. Well, if you're out of town and you got your golf clubs, the only thing you can do is go to where you want to play golf and say, connect me with somebody. You know, the first group of three that comes in that needs a fourth, I'll go. So you wind up playing golf with people you've never met, which is really entertaining. You can learn a lot about people's heads by how they golf, how they keep score, and what they do with the ball when they hit it, as it were. Well, it doesn't take very long before they say, well, what do you do? I have a choice. And because I can tell them I'm a clergyman or I can tell them I'm a college professor. And I don't have to tell them both because that just, their eyes roll with that. They can't get their head around that. Well, I make the decision in advance of what I'm going to tell depending on how the first hole or two goes. And when you're playing golf, if you've ever done this, sometimes there's a lot of God talk on golf courses. God! That kind of thing, right? Often, not always, you know, depends on how, you know, sometimes there's an alcohol component to that. I answer the question, what do? In other words, give up my identity, based on whether or not there's been a lot of God talk. Not a lot of God talk, I'll say, you know, college professor. Really? Sociology. Yeah, I took a sociology course once, like my root canal, right? If there's been a lot of God talk, however, like in God, I go, I'm an ordained minister in the Presbyterian Church. And they go, oh, Jesus. I go, oh, gotcha. We have a choice of how we present ourselves, and our jobs, our occupations, our professions are a key component of that. The way we talk, the way we dress, are reflections of who we want others to see us to be. So there's this distinction on a micro level between a job and a profession, and professions usually require a lot of training, credentialing, certifying, licensing, and so on. But the question is, what makes you happy on your job? Who's got a job that's imminently replaceable that they actually kind of like? Not terrible, it's okay. And do you kind of like it because of the people you work with? Yeah? Because every once in a while somebody asks your advice? And now and then? Yeah. Autonomy, people you like. Who likes their job because they pull pranks on people? You ever do that at work? That's kind of fun, isn't it? My best prank. And that the list is fairly long. And this one has been the heavyweight champion for quite some time. I worked as a program director in a YMCA, and I worked with a guy that I kind of liked, and we had parallel jobs, and we played racquetball with each other. Because we weren't making any money, and the racquetball courts were free for professional staff. And you play with members and get them, you know, schmoozing members was part of it. Well, in an 8 or 9 hour day, I bet there were days I played 5 or 6 hours of racquetball, which is great. So anyway, we're getting showered and changed after this, and he shows me his brand new locker lock, which was a big mistake. Whiz-bang locker lock that he said, yeah, and you can actually change the combination on this thing. You don't have to have the same combination. It's one of those little four-digit wheel things, right? He showed me how to change it. Then he hooked it to his locker, open, went and took a shower. Guess where this story's going? I could see what the combination was. He just taught me how to change it. He's in the shower. Change the combination, lock it, leave. We didn't have cell phones, and he couldn't text me and say, where are you? I let him sit there for about an hour. Gotta love it, don't you? It was a crappy job, and even a professional job, but boy, that's the day I remember. Job satisfaction, autonomy, co-workers, humor, etc. And that's why unemployment is so hard. Having been fired from a job, and I actually got fired from a job one time for which I had business cards. Yeah. And as I look back on it, you know, frankly, I had it coming. You know, and it spun me into a whole different part of my life, which I'm very grateful to be in. But what do you do with those business cards? They're kind of like touching a burn on your psyche. And I threw them out, you know, because it's a pretty serious hit to your identity when you are unemployed. In fact, when I went to graduate school, I still did the clergy gig. And when I was going to conferences like you went to the other day, and you're on the plane, and I'm older than your typical graduate student. I didn't start grad. I basically set my life on fire at about age 35. I did. Everything just went to pieces. And I went back to grad school. And in that process, I was still able to hold on to the clergy identity. So if I'm sitting next to somebody that works for CNN and this happened, we did the "what do you do on the plane?" "Oh, I work for CNN. I produce the Larry King show." "Really? What do you do?" "I'm in college. And I'm obviously pushing 40. You know." "No," I said, I'm a minister." That was a lot easier. It's not just what you are, it's what you're not, especially if you're not that anymore. So on this level, what you do is a key component to who you are. I am out of stuff. Questions? Now I got to call the IT people and ask them why they shut off my computer. One more lecture. See you Tuesday. Thank you.